From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of how rock music, magazine publishing, and a generation changed in the past two decades. A talk with Robert Draper, the author of A History of Rolling Stone magazine. Also today, we meet two guys who bring out the music other record companies lock up in their vaults. Harold Bronson and Richard Foose, the co-founders of Rhino Records. Rock historian Ed Ward dusts off some surf rock records. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Loony Bin Trip, feminist Kate Millett's memoir of her bouts with manic depression. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Ethnic violence continued today in the Soviet Republic of Kyrgyzstan. Interior Ministry officials say that at least 11 people were killed and hundreds were wounded in fighting in the Central Asian Republic. The fighting broke out yesterday in a land dispute between two Muslim ethnic groups. Soviet troops were unable to stop it, and a state of emergency has been imposed. Kyrgyzstan is a silk-producing region on the western border of China. It's more than 2,000 miles from Moscow. An American fighter jet in West Germany today collided with a civilian glider, killing the glider's pilot. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The F-16 fighter jet was on a routine training mission in central West Germany this afternoon when it collided with a glider. Local police in Rogenhausen, west of Frankfurt, say the pilot of the glider was killed instantly. There was only minor damage to the U.S. jet, and the two pilots were not injured. The pilots returned the plane after the accident to Hahn Air Force Base, a large U.S. military base in the state of Rhineland-Palatinate. The cause of the accident is not yet known, according to U.S. military authorities. Frequent low-flying training flights by NATO and West German troops in densely populated West Germany have become controversial in recent years. Protests have gotten louder since 70 people died after an accident in 1988 at a military air show in Ramstein. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
In Tokyo today, talks on the Cambodian conflict ended with a statement calling for voluntary restraint rather than a formal ceasefire. And the most powerful guerrilla faction, the Khmer Rouge, didn't endorse the communique. The BBC's Alexander Thompson reports from Tokyo that without Khmer Rouge agreement, the fighting seems likely to continue.
These talks between Hun Sen and Prince Sihanouk were intended to bring about a formal ceasefire, but they hit difficulties right from the start, with the Khmer Rouge insisting on equal participation, although Prince Sihanouk is supposed to be overall leader of the guerrilla coalition, and although it had been made clear that the talks would be two-sided. After intensive behind-the-scenes negotiations, the Japanese, who did not want their first diplomatic initiative aimed at furthering peace in Cambodia to be a flop, managed to persuade Prince Sihanouk and Mr. Hun Sen to sign a joint communique which calls for voluntary restraint on the use of force, but which falls far short of a ceasefire agreement. And although the prince and the leader of the other non-communist faction, Son San, say they will stop fighting, without the Khmer Rouge agreeing to a ceasefire, the conflict will continue.
The BBC's Alexander Thompson in Tokyo. Prices on the New York Stock Exchange came down a bit today, pressured by profit-taking after yesterday's record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which jumped 34 points yesterday, lost 10 points today to close at 2,925. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. Six American companies are moving ahead with plans to do business in the Soviet Union. The companies are all part of the American Trade Consortium that signed an agreement with its Soviet counterpart on Saturday. The agreement calls for Chevron Corporation, an ATC member, to study the possibility of developing oil reserves in Central Asia with a Soviet partner. If that deal works, oil exports would bring in hard currency that could be exchanged with the other consortium partners. The other partners are Eastman Kodak, Johnson & Johnson, Archer Daniels Midland Company, RJR Nabisco, and Mercator Investor Bank. NASA will make one final attempt at finding the fuel leak that's forced the Shuttle Columbia's launch to be delayed. Dave Pignanelli reports that technicians will begin loading hydrogen aboard the orbiter early tomorrow morning.
NASA engineers are spending today placing sensors around the 17-inch disconnect area of the shuttle. That's where fuel lines run from the external fuel tank into Columbia's engine compartment. At approximately 8 o'clock Eastern Time tomorrow morning, workers will begin running cryogenic hydrogen through fuel lines, hoping to recreate conditions when the leak first appeared. This past weekend, workers tried in vain to locate the leak by running helium through the lines. If tomorrow's test fails to produce any answers, Columbia will more than likely be rolled back to the vehicle assembly building, where engineers can begin disassembling the engine compartment. That would result in at least a one-month delay in liftoff plans. Only twice before has NASA had to remove a shuttle from the launch pad for repairs, the last coming in 1984. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Rebels in Liberia continued their drive on the capital city, Monrovia, seizing the rubber plantation that's one of the country's primary industries. Rebel troops are now reported to be preparing an assault on the international airport. President Samuel Doe was reported to be making a last effort at peaceful negotiations to end the six-month insurgency. He met with Christian and Muslim leaders today. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The magazine, once considered the voice of the counterculture, has more recently been called the Wall Street Journal of Rock and Roll. My guest Robert Draper has written a history of Rolling Stone magazine and how its changes reflect changes in the generation that the magazine was first written by and for, changes in rock music and magazine publishing, and changes in the life of the founding editor, Jan Wenner. Rolling Stone has been published every 2 weeks since 1967. Draper writes, by the end of the 60s, Rolling Stone was accepted as the authoritative rock and roll magazine. By 1971, Rolling Stone was what Esquire had been in the 60s, the breeding ground of explosive new journalists. 2 years later, the magazine began to make money. 3 years after that, it helped elect a president. By 1989, Rolling Stone's parent company, Straight Arrow Publishers Incorporated, was worth perhaps $250 million, over 30,000 times its value 22 years before. I asked Draper about the personal importance of the magazine in his life.
It was a publication that understood the thing that counted most to me and to my friends, rock and roll. If it understood rock and roll, then I could trust it to speak with authority on other issues as well. I probably began reading the magazine around 1970 or so. I remember letting my subscription expire in the early 80s, and at the time I wasn't really sure why. I suppose I just felt that the magazine had grown away from me or me away from it. It was in my investigation of the magazine that I began to realize that, in fact, the magazine had made a number of marketing adjustments consciously designed to alienate its original readership. So on that level, looking into the magazine's history was an opportunity for self-discovery, I suppose.
So you were a less interesting demographic later on in the magazine's history.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
What was the original identity of Rolling Stone as a music magazine? How did Rolling Stone's music coverage compare to the other rock magazines of the time?
Well, it was certainly more authoritative. From the outset, Rolling Stone attempted to do something that no other magazine had, which was simply cover the music scene with a certain solemnity, but sprinkled with a certain amount of humor. At the time, there were a few other publications, most prominently Crawdaddy, that were surveying the music scene and reviewing records. But frequently, they either tended to be trivial or tended to be reverential. Rolling Stone was neither. Rolling Stone covered rock and roll in much the same way that Time magazine would cover the Vietnam War. At the same time, I should add that Rolling Stone was always disdainful of objectivity, and so you would not find in its pages a sort of solemn impartiality. Rather, the magazine rejoiced in slamming things and pedestalizing things when they felt that was called for.
Can you give us a little capsule of what Jan Wenner was like when he founded the magazine?
Yeah, at the time, Jan Wenner was out of work. Jan was a 21-year-old Berkeley dropout who entertained no particular ambitions. He had been a very talented young man, but was not entirely certain how to channel his talents. It seemed that more than anything else, what had driven Jan was a desire to be, as I say in the book, in the company of greatness. Jan himself was never certain what that meant, but whatever fascinated him, wherever the action was, that's where Jan wanted to be. At the time, music was where the action was, and Jan was a diehard rock and roll fan. To Jan's credit, I should say that a number of people who I'd interviewed from the outset had led me to believe that Jan never understood rock and roll, and that's most certainly not the case. In fact, in 65 and 66, there was probably no one in America covering the San Francisco scene with the comprehensiveness and the authority that Jan Winter was. So Jan brought that to Rolling Stone. At the same time, I don't think that it was in the cards, or at least in Jan's mind, to create a magazine that would become the New Yorker of his generation. He was heard to tell people that he created Rolling Stone so that, quote, I can meet John Lennon, unquote. And I certainly think that there was an element of that. People from the outset were calling Jan the original fan or the ultimate groupie. And so his yearnings to meet people and to be where the action was propelled him throughout the first years and, of course, to this day.
Robert Draper is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, which is called Rolling Stone Magazine, The Uncensored History. Obviously, one of the strengths of Rolling Stone early on was its music coverage. It had some terrific writers like Greil Marcus, Lester Bangs, Ed Ward. Let's look a moment at some of like the more outstanding moments of the magazine's music coverage. In addition to the reviews, this was a little later on in the magazine's history. It covered the Altamont Festival, mm-hmm. and it covered it differently than the mainstream press did. Describe a little bit what was special about Rolling Stone's coverage of Altamont.
Well, for one thing, Rolling Stone, like all other magazines in America, had swallowed the Woodstock myth, hook, line, and sinker. Rolling Stone, however, was probably the first to disgorge the myth. Others such as Time magazine were prepared to cover Altamont as if it were a quote-unquote Woodstock West. Rolling Stone saw through that. Of course, Rolling Stone had a number of people there at Altamont that day and had seen the horrors perpetrated by the Hell's Angels. It was clear in the minds of the people who were there to cover the event, from Rolling Stone, Greil Marcus, John Morthland, Lester Bangs, Langdon Winter, and others, that Altamont was not only not a Woodstock, but probably ended for all time any notion of a Woodstock myth. Now, it was not their ambition to cover Altamont after that. They simply wanted it to go away. It was Ralph Gleason who first persuaded Jan Winter to go after Altamont full tilt, and Jan in turn who persuaded his troops, indeed ordered them, to not only cover Altamont completely, but to assess the blame, which in fact the magazine did. John Burks at the time was managing editor, and he sent out reporters to interview virtually everyone who had anything on any level to do with Altamont and put together a piece that you wouldn't find in today's periodicals. It was a disorganized piece. It sort of had a caterwauling flavor to it, but nonetheless was enormously thorough and covering every aspect of the concert and explaining exactly what went wrong and leaving no doubt in the reader's mind but that this was an event that could not in any way be confused with the Woodstock myth and, in fact, would end that myth for all time.
So in a lot of ways, this Rolling Stone edition on Altamont really changed the way Americans viewed the event.
Yeah, I think so, and the National Magazine Award certainly thought so because they awarded Rolling Stone a National Magazine Award in part for its Altamont coverage.
Let's look at some of the weaknesses of Rolling Stone's coverage of music. You write a lot about how reviews of records have often been influenced by the whims of the editor and publisher, Jan mm-hmm. Winter. Even early on, he tried to often control whether a review was positive or negative. Some examples
right.
of that?
Yeah, sure. It's among the people who were sort of sacrosanct at the very beginning were the Beatles, Dylan, and the Rolling Stones. Jan was always very, very vigilant regarding how or to what degree those individuals would be criticized. Bob Dylan, in particular, was exempted from any type of real critical scrutiny until, I believe, 1970, when Greil Marcus wrote something unfavorable about Dylan. He was subsequently fired. Not only in the early years, but in later years, Jan would always reserve the right to reassign reviews when their opinions were different than his. And typically, this would be when their opinions resulted in castigating someone who was a friend of Yan's. In fact, I think I quote one individual who says, it's always a risk to rate too low someone that Yan has had lunch with. Yan has always reserved that editorial right, unfortunately, that sort of sells short the credibility of the publication in terms of its music criticism.
There was a writers' protest in 1970. What were some of the issues at Rolling Stone that the writers were up in arms about?
Well, what was going on then was Kent State, People's Park, and a number of other very severe clashes between the establishment and the left. And this inflamed politically a number of people at Rolling Stone who had been involved in campus politics at Berkeley. Yan had always had a wavering commitment to the left. Ultimately, Rolling Stone was Yan's magazine, not the left's magazine, and Yan had demonstrated that on a number of occasions. But in 1970, when it looked like all hell was breaking loose on campuses, Rolling Stone's staff set out to do an issue, a Kent State issue, that would essentially advocate revolutionary means to overthrow the establishment. While this was going on, Yan was touring around New York and Chicago gathering advertisers and did not know that this issue was taking place. When he found out about it, he was extremely upset and essentially purged the staff of those who were involved. At the time, and this would happen throughout Rolling Stone's history, people who worked at Rolling Stone forgot essentially whose magazine it was. Since Yan was not involved in the day-to-day running of things, they often felt that the magazine was theirs, or at the very least, managing editor John Burks's. And they looked at Yan as nothing more than a hindrance. As John Carroll would say, he had it wrong. He said, "I thought our mission was to save the world." In fact, Rolling Stone had no mission. It was always what Yan Winter wanted it to be. And they drew up a list of principles to be affirmed when Yan returned from New York and Chicago, basically demanding more editorial control, demanding that Yan stay out of reviews, and a number of other things which Yan found unpalatable, as a result of which he discharged a number of members of his staff.
One of the things that makes it interesting to follow the history of Rolling Stone magazine is watching how a magazine that was written by members of a generation, for members of a generation, changed as the writers got older and changed as rock and roll changed. Mm-hmm. Was there something of a music crisis for the writers at Rolling Stone?
Yeah, I think there was. I mean, the crisis was primarily that of age. I mean, there began to be a generation gap. Rolling Stone's music critics by the mid-70s had reached their 30s and weren't paying nearly as much attention to whatever the cutting edge happened to be, intended to promote the same guys they'd been promoting since the late 60s. This was especially seen, or perhaps first seen, with the advent of disco, something that Rolling Stone staffers never understood and which, in Greil Marcus's words, we simply wished would go away. It was also seen with the beginnings of punk rock. There were a few new members that Rolling Stone had hired, especially the Reverend Charles M. Young, who had been great advocates of punk rock. There were a number of others, however, who found the that genre of music distasteful. Among these was certainly Yan Winter. It has been noted that Yan's taste in music probably has been informed by events that ended by 1973 or so. And Yan himself confesses to not having listened to, for example, Elvis Costello or the Sex Pistols. And so when this music would come around, Yan tended, as others did, to dig in his heels and insist that it was not worthy of attention, that it was simply sort of an anti-movement more than anything else. What this resulted in was Rolling Stone slowly ceding its position as the authoritative journal of record regarding rock and roll, and left others such as MTV an opening to come in and seize the crown.
Rolling Stone started as a music magazine, and then it became known as well for its political coverage. Why did politics take a more important place than it once had in the magazine? What was that representative of?
Well, it was representative of nothing more than Yan Winter's interests. I mean, at bottom, Rolling Stone has always been a window into Yan's yearnings, fantasies, and interests. And by this time, Yan was developing an interest in various politicians and political movements. It's probably closer to the mark to say that Yan has always been more interested in politicians than in politics itself. But at that time, after the 1972 political coverage, Jan was beginning to recognize that Rolling Stone could be a player in politics. He began to be courted by politicians, and this charmed Jan. So as a result, he began to hire out more and more people who would do political writing for them.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Robert Draper, and he's written a new history of Rolling Stone magazine. It's called Rolling Stone Magazine, The Uncensored History. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Robert Draper, and he's written a new history of Rolling Stone magazine. Let's look at the story of advertising in Rolling Stone, which I think really shows a lot, not only about how Rolling Stone changed, but how many things changed between the 60s and the 80s. Initially, because Rolling Stone was perceived as such the mouthpiece of the counterculture, and because it was a music magazine, just about all the ads were record company magazines, record company ads. And when Rolling Stone tried to branch out into other product advertising, they were turned down a lot.
Mm-hmm. They were. Rolling Stone was regarded by Madison Avenue as nothing more than a hippie publication, and this was especially seen in Jan's courting of Volkswagen. When Jan was seeking to wrest himself away from the dependence that he had on the music industry for ad revenues, he began to follow around Volkswagen representatives, trying to sell them on the virtues of Rolling Stone. It simply didn't take. Volkswagen was convinced, and partly because of the manner in which Jan would attempt to sell them on it, a sort of scattershot method that was very emblematic of Rolling Stone itself. Volkswagen was convinced that Rolling Stone would never amount to more than an anti-establishment publication. Rolling Stone had a curious, it is sort of an interesting sub-history to see how Rolling Stone changed in its advertising department. Its original advertising rate cards said right on them in sort of solemn tones that they would not accept advertisements from cosmetics companies and from the military. Each piece of ground that was given regarding who they would sell ads to and who they wouldn't sell ads to always came as a result of very, very heated debate, particularly whether or not to sell ads to the military, something that finally by the early 80s Rolling Stone was doing. And, of course, to this day, I think the current issue on the stands has a be-all-you-can-be ad in it. But that, of course, would have been unfathomable back in the late 60s while Vietnam was going on. And even things that now would seem almost laughable today, like whether or not to include liquor ads, were subject to enormously heated debate. Finally, ground was given in the mid-70s, I believe, when Joe Armstrong was publisher.
In 1985, Rolling Stone had a campaign geared toward advertisers to try to change the advertiser's image of the magazine. It was the Perception versus Reality campaign. Mm-hmm. Would you describe it?
Yeah, it was a generally speaking, a two-page ad. On the first page would be a picture of something that was emblematic of the hippie days, a peace symbol, a Volkswagen van, a long-haired hippie, and above that would be the word perception. On the second page, the facing page, would be the bold-faced word reality, and beneath that, something that would be emblematic of today's yuppie, where there would be a long-haired hippie on one page, there would be a very Tony-looking yuppie on the other. The intent being to show potential advertisers that Rolling Stone's reader had changed a great deal. It was a very, very clever campaign. At times, it was a fairly harsh campaign as well, because as Harriet Fear suggested, made all of that grist for the mill, made the 60s look like something that we could all sneer at. It was not simply suggesting that Rolling Stone's readers had changed. It was drawing up caricatures of what the readers had been like before, caricatures that were fairly mocking and downright cold.
Did it work in terms of getting new advertisers?
Unquestionably, it worked. I don't have the numbers in front of me to quantify it, but their ad revenues changed almost overnight. To this day, Rolling Stone runs Perception Reality ads, and indeed, Jan's other magazine, Us Magazine, uses Fallon McGillicutt Rice with a similar campaign pitting Us Magazine against its rival People Magazine. There's no question but that the Perception Reality campaign not only worked, but was admired throughout the industry. And as I say, it was an enormously clever campaign and played very effectively on well-worn images.
Did the campaign alienate either readers of Rolling Stone or its own writers?
It's difficult to say whether it alienated readers. There doesn't appear to be any evidence that its current readership was mortally offended by those. And of course, its current readership probably hasn't even seen a lot of those. They appeared mainly in trade magazines. Certainly, its writers were upset. When I interviewed people on the 23rd floor over at Rolling Stone, virtually everyone was embarrassed by the campaign and wanted to assure me that Rolling Stone was not, as they put it, about that campaign, and that this sort of thing was taking place, if not over their howling objections, then at least over their discontent. And at the same time, it was a battle, as far as the editorial people were concerned, that just wasn't worth fighting. It was clear that Jan loved the campaign, and these days at Rolling Stone, when you fight battles like that, you're just going to lose.
Another direction the magazine took in the 1980s was its marketing through music. Explain what that was.
Marketing through music was a newsletter put out by the Rolling Stone's business department. It was it did not actually say Rolling Stone magazine on it except at the very bottom, but it was clearly a Rolling Stone sponsored newsletter that intended to promote corporate sponsorship of rock and roll. The newsletter would be about 8 pages or so and would have a number of articles in it suggesting effective campaigns that certain businesses had used with various musicians as their actors or sponsors or whatever. And there would even be a column in the Marketing Through Music newsletter suggesting various ways that companies out there could exploit music for its own purposes. Again, this was an area that made the editorial folks on the 23rd floor rather ashamed. They had always indicated that there was no relationship, as far as they could tell, between what was put out in the magazine and marketing through music, and they wished that it would go away. Ultimately, it did. But what it did in the meantime was prevent Rolling Stone from taking a very hard stance on the corporate sponsorship of rock and roll, a fairly controversial topic, and there are intelligent arguments to be made on either side. Rolling Stone wouldn't take a side because it had essentially recused itself from the debate. After all, Rolling Stone was the official sponsor, in a way, of corporate sponsorship with its marketing through music newsletter. So that was an area in which Rolling Stone could have taken a very firm and influential stance, but could not.
What do you think of the state of the magazine today? I'm sure you've been reading it, if for no other reason than to do research for your book.
Well, I think that the magazine still consistently runs excellent articles, and frequently on subjects that no other people could touch. Rolling Stone has not sold out. It has not betrayed a particular stance. And indeed, Rolling Stone never had a stance to sell out, which was always the beauty of the magazine. Its flexibility and its ability to find positions between other extreme positions. What it has betrayed is not so much a principle, but its own excellence. And it does that on a biweekly basis. I mean, people these days, a number of people from its former readership, will look at Rolling Stone disdainfully as the magazine that puts Bon Jovi on the cover. And in not picking up that Bon Jovi issue, they will have missed an excellent article by Lewis Cole on crack. By sneering at the magazine that now puts Don Johnson on its cover, they will have missed David Black's award-winning article about AIDS. And that's a shame, and that's a betrayal unto itself.
Robert Draper, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Draper is the author of Rolling Stone magazine, The Uncensored History. Jan Wenner declined an invitation to speak on Fresh Air in response to Draper's criticisms, but through a spokesperson, Wenner said yes, he's had an influence, but no more than any other editor at any other magazine, and never so much as to compromise the integrity of Rolling Stone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, former Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, Dusko Doder. His new book is a political biography of Gorbachev. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's right, it's a surf version of Hava Nagila, just one of the sessions saved from obscurity by Harold Bronson and Richard Foose of Rhino Records. Coming up, Foose and Bronson on saving music that's too old, too obscure, too unprofitable, or too bad for other record companies. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the man who dared to play a surf version of Hava Nagila, guitarist Dick Dale. It's the first of Ed's two-part look at surf rock. And book critic John Leonard reviews Kate Millett's first-person account of mental illness. It's called The Loony Bin Trip. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials at the White House say that President Bush signed a trade treaty with Soviet leader Gorbachev, believing that the Soviet president wants to resolve a standoff with Lithuania, but without receiving concrete assurances. Congressional leaders who met with the president today at the White House said that Moscow will have to ease its economic ban in the Baltic Republic before Congress approves any of the benefits described by that new agreement. In Liberia, an attack by rebels on the massive Firestone rubber plantation is reported to have met little resistance, although government forces are said to be on their way. The plantation is considered vital to the Liberian economy. However, Elizabeth Blunt of the BBC reports, in spite of their gains, there are signs of dissension among the rebel forces.
For the rebels, Firestone, Liberia's best-known enterprise and the largest single rubber plantation in the world, is a prestigious acquisition if they can hold it, and a gold mine of the kind of supplies, petrol, food, and vehicles which they need for their advance. But with the final prize they're fighting for so near now to their grasp, there are signs of renewed dissension within the rebel movement. Reports are coming in from the Bunga area in central Liberia of serious and sustained fighting over the past 3 days, apparently between rebel factions. Bunga is now some 90 miles behind rebel lines, and there's no known Liberian army presence in the area. Similar fighting in February brought the rebel advance to a halt until Charles Taylor succeeded in asserting his authority.
Elizabeth Blunt of the BBC. A leader of last week's abortive attack on a crowded Tel Aviv beach has said on state-run Israeli radio and television that his mission was to kill as many Israelis as possible. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The 28-year-old member of the Palestine Liberation Front, Mohammed Ahmed Abu Shash, was interviewed on Israel TV's main news program. He said that his group's mission was to attack the Tel Aviv beach hotels full of Israelis enjoying a Jewish holiday last week. Abu Shash, the deputy commander, said his personal mission was to fire Katyusha rockets from the sea and then go into the Sheraton Hotel and kill as many people as possible. He also said the 20-member group trained with the Libyan Navy for a year and a half. But Israel Radio quoted defense sources that the army believes the group's targets were the American embassy in Tel Aviv and Israeli military installations. The chief of staff said that both Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and PLO leader Yasser Arafat must have known about the attack. 4 guerrillas were killed and 12 captured. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 10 points to close at 2,925, volume 200 million shares.
This is Fresh Air. Open-air concerts are usually the closest rock and roll gets to the great outdoors. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers when one sport generated a whole new style of music.
Let's go surfing now. Everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.
Thanks in large part to the fact that surf music these days is represented by the Beach Boys, and the Beach Boys are fronted by the smarmy Mr. Mike Love, it's probably never been as out of fashion as it is right now. So, now more than ever, some rehabilitation is in order. In 1960, the Ventures inaugurated the modern era of rock and roll guitar with Walk, Don't Run, an oh-so-catchy instrumental that was also fairly easy to play if you had one of those newfangled solid-body electric guitars. These soon became the instrument of choice for rock and rollers, especially in California, where teenagers seemed to have more money and spent more of it on leisure than anywhere else in the world. One thing Southern California teenagers were beginning to do was ride surfboards. This was an ancient Hawaiian sport, formerly reserved for the ali'i, the nobility. It was thrust into international focus by Duke Kahanamoku, the swimming gold medalist in the 1912 Olympics, who later surfed his way around the world. By 1960, surfing was an accepted bohemian pastime in California. By day, surfers would ride the waves, and by night, they'd party on the beach. Although surfers were among the first LSD users in the country, Let's Go Trippin' is, like most surf records, a song about riding surf. It was written and performed by a Lebanese-Polish guy named Dick Dale, who played in Greek restaurants and took other miscellaneous gigs to support his surfer lifestyle. Dale was in the right place at the right time. Let's Go Trippin' took off in California and even charted nationally, establishing him as the king of the surf guitar and becoming the first surfing hit. 2 months later, three brothers, their cousin, and a friend, only one of whom had ever been on a board in his life, decided to pool their high school rock band experience and jump on the bandwagon. It's amazing that this record, recorded in a tiny studio for an even tinier label, ever got heard at all.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf with me. Bob, dip, 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 bob, dip, dip. I got up this morning, turned on my radio. I was checking out the surfing scene to see if I would go. And when the DJ tells me that the surfing is fine, that's when I know my baby and I will have a good time. Go and surf, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, dip, surf, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, dip.
To promote the record, the band changed its name from the Pendletones, after the Pendleton flannel shirt surfers favored, to the Beach Boys, and before long they had Capitol Records knocking on their door. Surf music had been discovered. Hearing about the dance called the Surfer Stomp that surfers like to do to Dick Dale's music, Liberty Records quickly assembled a band, called them the Marquettes, and issued a Surfer's Stomp. Might have figured, it was Dick Dale who was putting down the real surf sound, thanks to a technological advance called the Fender Reverb, which he introduced on Misrilou, a favorite from his Greek restaurant days, where he showed off his bouzouki-style picking. We'll be right back. So far, though, surf music was an exclusively Californian phenomenon. With the exception of the Marquettes record on Liberty, none of these records was on a national label. But in the summer of 1962, Capitol, not known previously for setting trends, got its feet wet with Surfing Safari, the cover of which showed the group wearing Pendletons and hugging a board. It got to number 14. Young America was hearing the call of the waves, and next week I'll talk about how it rode the big surf over the next year.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. One of today's most eclectic and offbeat record labels got its start producing sessions like this, a kazoo orchestra version of the Led Zeppelin favorite Whole Lotta Love. My guests are the founders of Rhino Records, Harold Bronson and Richard Foose. They started the label from the back room of their Los Angeles record store, making promotional novelty records as Christmas gifts. Rhino is still known for novelty records, but they also release new records by new rockers. And one of their specialties is reissuing out-of-print classic rock and roll in anthologies and greatest hits collections featuring artists such as Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, Ricky Nelson, the Everly Brothers, and Roy Orbison.
Only the lonely know the way I feel tonight. Only the lonely.
Rhino is able to put out these rock and roll classics by leasing the original sessions from record companies. But as these collections become more successful, the record companies are less willing to part with music from their vaults. And the Rhino Boys say this has forced Rhino to be more creative.
We have an incredibly successful series that we released earlier this year called Have a Nice Day, which super hits of the 70s, and they're anthologies of the one-shot, one-hit wonder groups of the 70s that basically are all out of print, and it's been immensely successful.
Back to novelty for a minute and ask you about the Golden Throats collection, and it's basically an anthology of square celebrities singing rock hits. And I don't think that the celebrities who originally recorded these songs thought of this as novelty, but it's wonderful stuff and really very unintentionally hilarious. My favorite on the record is William Shatner singing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
How did you, whose idea was it to do this record?
Well, one of the things that we like to do is to encourage our employees to sort of join the bandwagon and get involved with some of our projects or to create new projects. And there were a couple of our employees who were in the mailroom who used to kind of top each other in these sort of battle of the worst record you've ever heard. And, you know, one day one would play one and then the next one would try and top it with something from his collection. And many of these records were coincidentally enough done by a lot of these celebrities. So quite often we're intrigued by artifacts, whether they're, you know, movies or in this case records, where the intent is different from the outcome. So in a lot of these cases, they thought that they were making good records or maybe credible at the very least. And in retrospect, when you hear these things, they're quite absurd when you think about that they really thought that they could sing and there's so little emotion or they're so limited in their, you know, their musicality.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with a sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
Because you've done so many novelty records over the years, do a lot of nuts show up at your door and offer themselves to you, thinking that they'll make a great record for you?
It is a little frustrating that every time anybody in the industry gets an idea for a novelty record, eventually they'll come to us and say, you know, and, you know, the truth is... you know, although we still do novelty records, it's more done in a compilation concept a la Golden Throats.
The main problem is that radio has really changed. And prior to about 20 years ago, novelty records were a dominant part of, you know, the top 30, whether it was Yes, We Have No Bananas to Alan Sherman, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada to Purple People Eater. There was always at least one novelty record, you know, in the top 30. And because radio has taken itself a lot more seriously, it tends not to want to play these records at all or to play them with the consistency that it used to. So therefore, even though Richard and myself feel passionately about a lot of this music, it becomes difficult to release it because if people don't hear it, then how do they know that they want to buy it?
What are some of the most important differences that have evolved in the record industry since you started putting out records?
I think it would be very difficult to be to have our success again. I don't know if you could, like, slip in and find a niche and be successful. I think it would be even more difficult than it was when we started.
You see, when we started, a lot of our inspiration came from the small upstart labels in the 50s and 60s. These were, generally speaking, music men who... You know, whether they had a vision or not, they had the energy to find local talent and sign them. And there was a plethora of all of these independent labels, whether they be White Whale Records or Kama Sutra Records and a lot of these strange names. And it was more of an immediate aspect of, you know, when you find the music, you put the band in the studio and the record was out in maybe a week or two. And as the business has progressed, quite often you have contract negotiations which take, you know, 6 or 7 months. That's not really uncommon. And then especially in the last year with a lot of the major record labels combining with other labels or acquiring others, it's become much more consolidated and much further away from that, you know, instantaneous emotional reaction and response that it used to be, and we feel that it gets further and further away from the emotional aspect of music. It becomes much more corporate. You have more and more business people involved who lack the musical sensitivity that people used to have years ago. And you have fewer of the great, record businessmen that you hear about from various eras.
As the music business becomes more corporate and as rock labels get swallowed up by larger and larger multinationals, does it become more difficult for you to negotiate for the rights that you need to put out records, when you want to license records from another company?
Yes, definitely. It's much more difficult. And especially with the CD boom, all of the companies rediscovered their own archives and have aggressive reissue programs, and a lot of them will admit that we were one of the prime pioneers in showing the industry that there is a lot of life in these older recordings. So we're, I guess, victims of our success.
You have a record coming out soon of Jack Kerouac reading his poems accompanied by Steve Allen, on another record accompanied by, was it Zoot Sims and Al Cohn?
Right.
And these records are real collector's items. They've been very hard to find for people who wanted them and very expensive to get. I was wondering if it was hard for you to get the rights to these recordings.
That's one we sort of fell into because last year we purchased the Roulette Records catalog, and the label he was on, which was, I think, Hanover Signature, was included in that purchase. And actually one of our A&R people who was a Kerouac fan discovered that we owned those recordings, and we went and found, I think, in a tape box marked something completely different, we found the original tapes, and we were very proud to put this out.
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend. In red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work in offices, in the air you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy. As soon they'll be charging en masse from Market and Sansom buildings on foot and in buses and all well-dressed through working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers. And even the poor, grime-bemarked 3rd Street of lost bums, even Negroes, so hopeless and long left east and meanings of responsibility and try. That now all they do is stand there spitting in the broken glass, sometimes 50 in one afternoon against one wall at 3rd and Howard. Here's all these Milbrae and San Carlos neat-necktied producers and commuters of America and steel civilization rushing by with San Francisco Chronicles and green call bulletins, not even enough time to be disdainful. They've got to catch 130, 132, 134, 136, all the way up to 146. Till the time of evening supper in homes of the railroad earth, when high in the sky the magic stars ride above the following hotshot freight trains. It's all in California. It's all a sea. I swim out of it and
Jack Kerouac with Steve Allen at the piano. Rhino Records will bring out the Kerouac collection later this month. I spoke with the founders of Rhino, Richard Foos and Harold Bronson. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us with a look at what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing today about a meeting of foreign ministers in Europe, including those of the Soviet Union, West Germany, and the United States. Closer to home, we'll be hearing about a redistricting, political redistricting of Los Angeles County, a talk with Thomas Sowell, the conservative black economist, who is a critic of affirmative action programs, not just in this country, but worldwide. And we'll also be hearing about a problem that, perhaps you've dealt with it already, Terry, but it's a pressing issue.
What is it?
Lost time capsules.
Ah, yes. I've had that problem all the time at home.
It's a national problem, and we'll be hearing from someone who has a solution.
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Kate Millett's 1970 bestseller, Sexual Politics, was one of the seminal works of the contemporary women's movement. Since then, Millett has written several other works of fiction and nonfiction, including The Prostitution Papers, Sita, and Going to Iran. Her new book is about how American society deals with mental illness. It's written from her own perspective as one who has suffered from bouts of manic depression. Book critic John Leonard has a review of The Loony Bin Trip.
I've written many reviews I regret, but none more so than a condescending put-down 13 years ago of Kate Millett's Sita. I said then that I hoped Millett, having published Sita and rid herself of so much embarrassing ticker tape, was happily at work somewhere on a real book. I owe her an apology. What she was doing 13 years ago was trying to keep herself sane. A manic depressive, she was doped up on lithium. 3 years later, in the summer of 1980, on the farm in upstate New York where she sought to establish a commune for women artists, she stopped taking her drug. The Loony Bin Trip is her scary account of what happened next. In stages, the mania overwhelmed her, and her friends and her loved ones. She speaks bitterly of their betrayal of her to what she calls the organization and the web, a conspiracy of police, psychiatry, family, property, religion, and state medicine. She reports on her escape to Ireland, where she was kidnapped from an airport and dumped in an asylum. She describes her fear of electroshock, psychosurgery, chemicals, and solitary confinement. She was rescued, as if from the Middle Ages, and returned to New York, to her loft on the Bowery, where, of course, depression was waiting for her. Depression, she says, is when you agree with them all and surrender. Depression, she thinks of as grief. She went back on lithium for another 7 years. She's been off it again since March. The Loony Bin Trip, which Millett calls her death book, is in every way extraordinary. She is writing for her life. We descend with her into the mania, a kind of flooding under of the self by history and culture and dream and myth. She is obsessed with the sexual organ of a horse, to whom she has given her father's name. She identifies with Joan of Arc. For all the danger and betrayal, she says, still consider the wonder of reconnecting with the figure and the circumstance, fused for those electric seconds with the heroic ordeal that the witch hunt became for the hunted. She sinks daily to a hell she describes as diabolic roulette with the red Pope devil at the bottom. She is sure her night nurse works for the CIA. The crazy scholar in her hopes in the loony bin to find a password, maybe in Gaelic, to what she calls race memory, mother wit, the memory of women betrayed. As lush as the mania, as bleak the depression. Consciousness is suffering, she says. Thought is nothing but recrimination. Even language is lost to her, shriveled. In the face of this evil, she tells us, not even to have words to protect one from the vacuum, to grow mute as well as helpless. For all this, she denies there's any such thing as madness. Crazy isn't a crime, it's a point of view. Those of us who've lost loved ones to insanity and self-destruction will object. Her biology here is as shaky as it was in Sexual Politics. But so is her criticism just as savage. As in the pages of Sexual Politics on D.H. Lawrence and Norman Mailer, so in her passages here on Life in the Asylum, she stares at everything we've refused to see, the old and the outcast as political prisoners. Drugs like lithium, thorazine, and prolixin as instruments of social control, a lobotomizing of the dreamers. She speaks for all those who've ever been locked up against their will, like Solzhenitsyn from the Gulag.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Loony Bin Trip by Kate Millett. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Allison Dufty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine the growing tensions between Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, the new head of the Russian Republic. My guest, Dusko Doder, is the author of a new political biography of Gorbachev. Also, we meet Don Byron, a black clarinetist who leads a band that plays Jewish klezmer music. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you join us for the next Fresh Air.